Blog Talk Radio.
Thanks for joining me for another Saturday afternoon with me, Carolyn Yeager. I just got a really great donation. I have to mention it. It just came, or I just saw it before the show started, from Ronald in Colorado. I give his last name, but I'm not sure he wants it mentioned. So I want to thank Ronald very, very much. It is June 14th, Flag Day in the USA, as I recall it to be. And a few diehard patriots will put out the stars and stripes on their lawn, their house, or their business. I remember when I was very young, our flag being set in the middle of the circular flower garden in the middle of the backyard. I don't remember when that ceased, but it did eventually. At that time that I was born, as I said, you had better show your allegiance to your country, and especially if you were German, of German extraction. And that's actually, mentioning that, as I recalled it, is actually pertinent to today's program, which is with Paul Hickman, who is British and a host of the White Network, was a host at the White Network, and is now doing his show, Voice of Albion, at Renegade Broadcasting. Thanks for coming on, Paul.
Hi, Carolyn. Thanks for having me.
Well, I wrote to you and I asked you if you'd be willing to do this topic with me. And you agreed to, so I'm very glad you're doing it. And you also sent me a list of topics that we could explore with links to information about them, so I used that. And that's basically what today's program is using for our structure. So I appreciate that. And as you know, and as our listeners probably all know, 2014 is the 100th anniversary of the First World War. That began in August 1914. I felt I need to talk about World War I this year as much as possible and, you know, dig into the nitty-gritty, because you'd probably agree with me that World War I or the Great War is pretty much is not given the attention, at least we could say, that World War II is. Isn't that right?
Yes, I agree with that.
Yeah, and, of course, World War II has more advanced weaponry, you know, more death, more destruction, more of everything even than the first one. And so we kind of, people don't know as much about it, including myself. So I have been enjoying learning more and more, and I hope to do a few more programs.
Well, I thought to myself, if the white race does disappear in 200 years' time, which I don't think it will, but it's a possibility, if that does happen and they look back in history books, I think it will be 1914 when they say that was the beginning of the end of those people, meaning us.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah. You know, there's a lot of truth to that. You can always find beginnings, but I would say that was a major beginning. It certainly didn't begin with World War II, did it? It certainly began here, and even World War II began here. So if we really want to understand things, this is where we need to go. And what I found is that the general ideas that let's say German sympathetic people have had is that World War I was was just this British antagonism toward Germany, and this unwillingness to face the competition from Germany, and so Britain had it out for Germany and managed to talk other people into ganging up on Germany, and that's what happened. And because they were so harsh on Germany with the Versailles Treaty, which was mostly because of France that wanted to be so punitive, and nobody else cared enough, so that led to Hitler and World War II. But and the fact is that this is basically, on a very general, you know, outlook, basically pretty true. But there's a whole lot more to it.
I can't argue with that much.
Yeah, there's a whole lot more to it that really needs to be understood. That's much too simplified. So we're going to do a lot in going into some of the things that were a part of leading up to this war, and I think this is going to be a great program.
Well, the history books will tell us that it was to do with the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand in the East,
right,
which got Russia involved, and it was to do with a very old treaty with Belgium, which made the British act and declare war because Belgium neutrality was affected. But that's pretty bogus. I mean, those things may have contributed, but there was a lot more to it than that, and it goes a lot further back than that, as we should.
Well, that's
discuss.
Right. And, you know, I was aware of particularly the Ferdinand thing. Most people are, but I haven't even. We're not even talking about that today, because if you don't know about that, well, then you should know about it already. You don't need to hear about it from us, right?
No. Yeah. That's right.
But that's good, because you're right. Those two things are generally, I didn't even been thinking about what the history books tell us, but those two things are probably what it is.
That's the standard line. That's what you get your marks for in an exam, for parroting those points.
And then you also get a belligerent, warlike attitude of Wilhelm II and the German, Imperial Germany, right?
I mean, yeah, there was that propaganda about Germans putting babies on bayonets in Belgium, and, you know, the picture of the Hun as a big King
Well,
Kong.
Even before that, though, they were saying that, you know, that Germany had this aggressive attitude.
Yes.
And the others were pretty much trying to deal with that. So, well, we'll see. We'll see what the truth of this is. So we've agreed to start with the Naval Defense Act of 1889, which is a British Act, right?
Mm-hmm, Act of Parliament.
Yeah, and so would you like to start out with that?
Yeah, sure. Stephen E. Lobel wrote in The Challenge of Hegemony, Grand Strategy, Trade and Domestic Politics, 2009, page 65, "The navalists convinced the government that the best way to protect Britain and its empire was to maintain a two-power standard as an absolute minimum. Britain's Admiralty argued that by building more ships than France and Russia combined, naval programs, and by building them faster, the Naval Defence Act 1888 and the Spencer Act 1894 would discourage the naval aspirations of these rising states and also deter future naval challenges. The Naval Defence Act would bring Britain's fleet up to a two-power standard by constructing 10 battleships, 42 cruisers and 18 torpedo gunboats over 5 years at a cost of $21.5 million. So basically they're saying they have to have twice as many ships as the two neighbouring powers who are competing, and at that time, 1889, it was Russia and France.
Right, and they wanted it combined, the two other powers combined.
Yes.
So that would, even if both powers, I guess the way I could think about it, even if both powers declared some kind of aggression on them, they would have enough to fight both of them.
That's right.
Yeah.
So Lobel continues, "As Hamilton noted, if there are any nations abroad who do wish to compete with us in naval armaments, the mere enunciation of the scheme will show to them the utter futility of their desire. The navalists were joined by London's financial interests, who supported punishing France and Russia through increased naval construction, while ship owners feared that in the event of war, trade would be entrusted to ships sailing under neutral flags." End the quote there. So even before the rise of Germany's navy, we see the attitude of the British And you can imagine how they took German naval growth a bit later on. And also interesting to note the line about London's financial interests.
I made a note of that.
Yeah, they're always there. They always
for sure, because they're getting people to. This is how these countries got into debt at this time. They started already here with this naval race, and so they, you know, as long as they're spending money, and then they'll have to borrow some money, and then that's good for the financiers.
That's right.
Yeah.
So that's what I have on the 1889 Naval Defense Act.
Okay. Let's see. Well, there's also something called the Spencer Program, which followed that in 1894. It wasn't as big of a deal as that, but it aimed to match foreign this was a British program, aimed to match foreign naval growth at a cost of over $31 million. And it says that instead of deterring the naval expansion, which is what they're trying to do with all of this, you've already pointed that out, they contributed to a naval arms race. And the other powers the other powers included Germany and the United States, both also bolstered their, no, I'm saying this wrong. Those other powers you mentioned, France and Russia, were in also joined by Germany and the United States, bolstered their navies too in the following years, and so Britain continued to increase its own naval expenditures.
So it gets a bit silly. I mean, how can you have twice as many ships and navy power when other states like the USA and Germany are growing? You would think it would be a time to say, okay, we've had a good run, we've ruled the oceans for 300 years more or less, now how about we have an ally with Germany who are very closely related to us and whose head of state, Kaiser Wilhelm, is related to our royals, and maybe share some of the goodies and share some of the responsibilities. But that was never taken up, unfortunately.
Well, yeah, that wasn't something that they were that the British were willing to do, and I suppose, well, for a lot of reasons, they felt they had to maintain that naval superiority to the extent they did. But you're right, it creates a race that is no good for anybody, because it wasn't, if everybody's keeping up all the time and they're just more spending more money and going into debt, well, you know who that benefits. So then a few notes I've got here about Germany I do want to mention, because my friend Willie Wenger reminds me of this every so often, that the Austro-Hungarian Navy, which was called the K&K Kriegsmarine, King and Kaiser, sort of like Kriegsmarine, was the sixth largest in the world at the time. At the end of the war, at the Versailles Treaty, they deprived Austria and Hungary of both. They were separated then, and deprived them of their water rights. I mean, they didn't have any water around them anymore, so they couldn't have a navy, and they had then their navies, particularly the Austrian Navy, was taken, you know, stolen and whatever, and that was how they dealt with that. But
Austro-Hungarian Empire was huge.
Yes, it was.
And then when you see, if you watch one of the documentaries where it shows after the war when it was just Austria, it's tiny compared to what it was.
And you know, they took so much away from what was considered. See, Austria and Hungary were kind of combined, but they both had their own territories. They took even more territory away from Hungary than they did from Austria, than from the Austrian part. I mean, Hungary was really big, and the whole thing combined was large. But, you know, and they were, I read that at a certain time, Germany was the sixth, before Germany started its naval race, really in earnest, it was the sixth largest navy in the world, and it shortly became the second largest after Britain, because Russia and France dropped out, kind of, and you know, then Austria, well, I don't know, this is all before.
Yeah, Russia and France kind of acquiesced and thought, well, there's no point even trying against the British Navy, we'll concentrate on land. And Kaiser Wilhelm is quoted as saying, you know, you police the seas, I'll police Europe, I'll police the land.
Yeah, he was willing to do that too.
Yeah, he was.
And, you know, that's shades of Adolf Hitler, who later was trying to do that.
He very much,
you know,
very much
so. After all that Wilhelm, I was reading all about Wilhelm, and I'm very interesting. We'll get into that in a little bit, but and I'm kind of getting ahead of myself here, but after all that happened to Wilhelm II with his aspirations and trying to get along with the British, and he was Queen Victoria's granddaughter. His mother was Queen Victoria's daughter. I mean, he was half exact. They're all mixed up. A lot of those British royals are more German than they are British, but they, you know, their parents,
yes,
is one thing or another. But
Vicky was his mother, and she was half German.
Yeah, that's right. So that, you know, they're so German, but they don't see it that way. Well, there was a time when they were trying to get along, but then that we'll talk about that. So, but after all that, and it failed, you'd think Adolf Hitler would not have, this would have brought to my mind, would not have, you know, gotten into the same mindset that, well, the British are the best people for us to team up with, and they can rule the sea, and we can have the big land army and so on. And he didn't have any success with that either.
No, it seems to be a blind spot of Hitler to think that way.
Well, it seems to be a blind spot of a lot of people. And the answer I came up with, which is not maybe right, but it's one thing, is that we all tend to admire the British. And no matter what the British do and how callous they can be, it's hard not to admire them. I admire the British, and there's another thing we admire is the British, the way British people speak, their accents, and they're pretty good looking people, and at least they look kind of elegant, or they look like they should rule the world.
We invented suits, you see, in Savile Row, and that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
The whole gentleman thing comes from Britain, although the Italians kind of took over a bit with their Armani and all that kind of thing, but. It did start with Britain.
Yeah.
In London,
the
yeah.
British win. The Italians don't end up winning, but the British do win. They use very ruthless tactics, but they still, you know, they remain on top, and it's hard not to admire that.
Those days are gone.
Yeah. Well, so I'll just add here about the naval race, that the German, as far as German Navy goes, the Imperial Navy was the first to operate submarines successfully, and that's about the only thing they were successful in. They couldn't match the battleships of the Royal Navy. They built a lot of them, or a number of them, but the Royal Navy still had better shells and propellant and so on, and they tried to kind of build a different kind for different purposes, but
The British invented the dreadnought, which was
then that dreadnought
next
came
class,
on,
yeah.
And everybody was building their own dreadnoughts. I didn't even find out what a dreadnought actually is. What has bigger guns or something, right?
Yeah, it's like the next stage of development. It's like a leap in technology.
Yeah, well, what was the technology that was improved in the dreadnought?
I don't know if it was mostly going from coal to oil, which made it a lot faster. Or I don't know all the details of that.
Oh.
It was kind of, as I understand it, it was a bit like the Bismarck. That was kind of a leap forward.
I was reading that one of some of these, the German battleships, I don't know if it was the battleships, but probably, that they had made innovations, and one of them was putting, putting coal, storing the coal, they were still using coal, storing the coal, in the exterior, behind the exterior shell of the ship or something, which could help to deflect missiles and torpedoes and so on. Mm. Things like that. They were just really going
to
town.
Little things add up, and then the other side copies the other side, and that's how the technology goes forward.
But here's where the Germans were not handling their money too well, and they were adding to their national debt because of all these naval expenditures. And here's where Wilhelm kind of got carried away. But he had a naval minister, Tirpitz, who also wanted to do that. So he was being encouraged to to try to build up this competitive navy, and their shipbuilding was more expensive. The British had come up with some kind of a cost reduction thing by keeping their shipbuilding going all the time, even if they weren't at it at such a high pace, and that somehow brought down costs because they weren't closing down the shipyards and opening them up again, and they kept the workers working. But the German ships were ended up 30% more expensive than a British ship of the same equivalency.
Mm-hmm.
And so this contributed to opposition in the Reichstag to any further expansion, particularly when it was clear that Britain intended to match and exceed any German expansion program.
Yes.
You know, which is what you were saying earlier.
And I suppose the British would have the advantage of such a vast empire to get all these goods very cheap or for free.
Well, there you go.
Germany would have to cough up and, you know, they'd have to pay the going rate, as it were.
Yeah, and so there were complaints in Germany about this, and, you know, didn't like it, and the State Secretary of the Treasury, Hermann von Stengel, resigned because he could see no way to resolve the budget deficit. And now let's see, my last thing here is the... Germany concentrated on battle cruisers and that weren't quite as fast as... maybe they were a little bit faster than the British battleships, but anyway, that's not too important. I copy all this stuff down. The last thing I'll say is the German Navy's U-boats were also instrumental in the sinking of the passenger liner and auxiliary cruiser Lusitania on May 7th, 1915, which led to the USA.
I think that is another one of these propaganda things, isn't it? Like the British being bound by honour to declare war on Germany because of some ancient treaty with Belgium. It's a bit like that with the Lusitania, I think, because Germany had placed papers in the American adverts in the American papers saying, look, any allies of Britain, we are at war, who are flying British flag or allied, is risk of being sunk. And it's also been proven of the logs from the Tirpitz that they was carrying munitions, large amounts of munitions. It wasn't just passengers. So I think that is a bit of an excuse, the Lusitania thing.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was what's called a, what is that called?
Is that a canard?
Well, no, it's they use it as a pretext.
It's
a pretext for going to war when it really wasn't a reason. Yeah. Everybody was troubled. Germany was trusting Wilson as the best of a bad lot of all the others, you know, the Allied heads of state. And Wilson was just, you know, turned out to be just as bad because he was controlled by the Jews. Mm. So there we get into the Jews a little bit later on. But right now, you're right, the financial interests coming in are all Jewish. So they're there, but this is a thing, supposedly, between the British establishment and the German establishment in trying to compete with one another and be the greatest. Now we can go on to the South Africa situation. There's a lot of, factors to this.
Yeah. Would you like me to talk about the Kruger Telegram and the events that led up to it?
Well, right. I want to, before the Kruger Telegram, I just want to, the events that led up to it.
Okay.
What I'm starting with here is 1895, Cecil Rhodes. I don't want to forget to bring him into it because
I've got it a bit further back than that.
Okay, well, you get started then.
Okay, and it's all the same kind of thing. You'll see any other European power, whether German or Dutch, the British will not let them have anything. They have to get their share. So, most of this is from Wikipedia, but I did go on about six different pages to get all this. If you try getting other searches, they keep quoting Wikipedia anyway. So I think it's...
Oh, I know. I gave up on that because every other page I go to, Well, it's not even as good as Wikipedia because it's just copied from Wikipedia.
Yes.
And it doesn't have the other things that Wikipedia offers as much. So mm-hmm. you might as well. That's the place to start.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you check out where there's no citations and, you know, and just notice what the citations refer to and where it's coming from and so on. That's the important part.
That's right. So, firstly, South Africa History Online says, by 1895, Britain was getting more confident about taking action in South Africa. Joseph Chamberlain was appointed Colonial Secretary. He joined forces with Cecil Rhodes to try and develop and promote the British Empire in South Africa. A note here of mine, the Afrikaners had been there since the 1600s.
That's right. You know, do you have a story about them a little bit more? I don't know if I have a little something stuck in.
Yeah, I do, but the thing that I can't understand with this whole thing, Britain had their own empire in the 1700s, 1800s. I mean, they had America for a long time, they had Canada, they had Australia, New Zealand, they had India, and they didn't have enough men to deal with all those places. So you'd think that they'd carry on with that, but no. And there's certain hands behind the curtain who are pushing for this as well. It's it wasn't, as you'll see, a kind of racial thing. Nothing to do with race whatsoever. So Wikipedia says, well, I say first, South Africa wasn't one country in 1895. Wikipedia, first you had the Cape Colony. The British started to settle the eastern border of Cape Colony in the 1820s. They also began to introduce the first rudimentary rights for the Cape's black African population and, in 1833, abolished slavery. The resentment that the Dutch farmers felt against the social change, as well as the imposition of English language and culture, caused them to trek inland. So you've got the Great Trek. So these were the four states which made up what is now known as South Africa. Natal. Natal was proclaimed a British colony in 1843, and hold on one second.
Yeah, and I'll just fill in here. The British, it says, I've got down here that the British formally acquired the colony in 1814 and encouraged immigration by British settlers who were largely at odds with the Dutch settlers who were already there.
And, that's right.
And many Boers were dissatisfied with aspects of the British administration, in particular with Britain's abolition of slavery, which they wanted to use, I guess. That's a big mistake they made. Elected to migrate away from British rule in what became known as the Great Trek, and that's what you're talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, however, it was not until 1845 that an effective administration was installed as Lieutenant Governor. Then the power of the Boer Volkstrad finally came to an end. The tiny British settlement was almost strangled at birth when the Boer Great Trekkers arrived from the Cape Colony. So, and then you have the Orange Free State. The Republic's name derives partly from the Orange River, which in turn was named in honour of the Dutch royal family, the House of Orange. The official language was Dutch. In 1824, farmers of Dutch, French, Huguenot and German descent, called Voortrekkers, which means a pioneer in Afrikaans, came from the Cape Colony, so they'd been pushed out of the Cape, who were seeking both pasture for their flocks and to escape British government oversight, settled in the country. The Free State established a temporary government over the diamond fields, but the administration of this body was satisfactory neither to the Free State nor to the diggers. At this juncture, Nicholas Waterbury offered to place the territory under the administration of Queen Victoria. The offer was accepted, and on 27th October 1871, the district, together with some adjacent territory, which the Transvaal had laid claim, was proclaimed British territory. End Wikipedia quote. So there they've already got hold of two of these states.
Okay, well, you got up to 1871 pretty quickly, so I'm just a little bit...
Yes.
There was fighting among the Boers, or people between the Transvaal and the Orange. Then some others formed the Orange Free State, and
a bit of that.
Yeah, they didn't. You know, they were independent-minded people,
mm-hmm.
and Now, they were very Bible-oriented, weren't they?
I believe so.
They were really religious, and that's why they wanted to be there, and they wanted to create their own kind of a thing. And they would disagree with one another, and then some group would follow, the leader of one faction, and they'd go off and find their own area so they could do it their way. You know, how independent people, so similar to white nationalism, and white nationalist history in that, we'll do it this way, and well, we don't like what you're doing now, we'll go and do it this way. And, you break up into groups, but nobody is ever all that successful. But they were tough people, and they did win some battles, and they were trying to keep the British away. I know that. They were trying
That's right.
to stay free of the British, and they weren't really interested in the gold and the diamonds. They didn't even really know about when they found out how much gold was there later on, then they wanted to protect that for themselves because they knew it would be taken over. But they were just looking for freedom.
Freedom and farmland and their own culture and language.
Right.
The reason I get to 1871 so quick because you have to take them separately because this is all leading up to the Kruger Telegram.
All right.
So that you had Natal, then you had the Orange Free State. And this is the Transvaal. This is all going on, same kind of time, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
The Transvaal, also known as the South African Republic, Wikipedia, in the 1830s and 40s, descendants of Dutch and other settlers, collectively known as Boers, farmers, or war trekkers, pioneers, left the British Cape Colony in what was to be called the Great Trek. In 1877, after the 1896 Witwatersrand Gold Rush, Britain annexed the Transvaal. So they already got the Cape Colony, Orange Free State, now they annexed the Transvaal. In December 1880, the independence of the Republic was proclaimed again. The Boer says, no, we want it back, leading to the First Boer War. Kruger was elected president in 1883, and the Republic was restored with full independence. In 1884, with the London Convention, but not for long. The Gold Rush also brought an influx of non-Boer European settlers called Uitlanders, which means outsiders in Afrikaans, leading to the destabilization of the Republic. So that was the first Boer War, which I think was quite minor to the second one.
Right.
And that brings us to the Kruger Telegram. The Kruger Telegram was sent by Germany's Kaiser Wilhelm II to Paulus Kruger, President of the Transvaal Republic. On 3rd January 1896, the Kaiser congratulated the President on repelling the Jameson Raid, a sortie by 600 British irregulars from Cape Colony into the Transvaal under the command of Leander Jameson. The raid was intended to trigger an anti-government uprising by the primarily British expatriate miners, but was a fiasco, with 65 of the raiders killed to only one Boer commando, and the rest surrendering. The telegram caused huge indignation in the UK and led to a further inflammation of tensions between Britain and Germany. The telegram read, I express to you my sincere congratulations that you and your people, without appealing to the help of friendly powers, have succeeded by your own energetic action against the armed bands which invaded your country as disturbers of the peace. In restoring peace, and in maintaining the independence of the country against attack from without. That was Kaiser Wilhelm the second telegram. So after the Jameson raid, the Boer people, the Afrikaners, had decided we're going to keep the Transvaal for us. And that's what led to the second Boer War.
All right, so the Kruger Telegram came first, and it came after the Jameson Raid.
Yes, the Jameson Raid was like an attempt to foment like disruption in the country, and you had those Uitlanders there.
Well,
let me
tell a little bit about the Jameson Raid then, because I've got that here. It was a botched raid on Paul Kruger's Transvaal Republic, carried out by this, as you said, colonial guy, they call him a colonial statesman, Leander Star Jameson, but he was actually just a hired hand of Cecil Rhodes. and working for him. And he had gotten down there for various reasons, because his health was bad and so on. And he ended up getting involved with Rhodes and the gold mines and so on. And he was employed by the British South Africa Company, which was owned by Cecil Rhodes and Alfred Beit. And it actually started out with Cecil Rhodes, and then Alfred Beit joined him. Alfred Beit was a Jew. Cecil Rhodes was not. But Cecil Rhodes was certainly a homosexual. Since the last time I talked about him, I said I was wondering about it, but people accuse me of calling everybody, you know, a homosexual. But he actually was, because I read more about him since, Paul. And there was one story at the end that convinced me totally that okay. For sure he was. And I won't go into that story, but he was, you know, lovesick over this one man who got injured in an accident, and he was nursing him back to health. And he wouldn't even allow, for 2 weeks after this happened, and he was nursing this man who worked with him, and he was younger. He wouldn't even allow a single business information to come to him. And he was a real businessman, you know. That's what he was doing, and he wouldn't hear anything. Nothing could reach him. He was just totally, and he was, later on the man died, and he was heartbroken, and they said he couldn't even speak about it without crying for the rest of his life. Mm. So then I found out that Alfred Beit is never married either, and these people always married in these days, you know. You had a wife.
Oh, yeah.
Generally you did. Now, they were true, they were in South Africa, but they could have even had a family back in Britain or something. But he was, and they were closely, I saw a picture of the two of them there. So I suspect that he was too. But anyway, they, because, you know, I just have to say that these people are more likely to not care about regular people and to be more ruthless in the way they behave and so on, just like Jews are. And this man was both a Jew and probably homosexual. And they wanted to just steal the stuff. They were just invading the Boers and what they had there. And it was failed. It totally failed, the Jameson raid. Yeah.
And the greed of it is just astounding.
Yes, it is.
How much do you want?
Cecil Rhodes is the one who, we have to look into him some more yet. He's the one who had the idea that the British people and the English-speaking people should actually dominate the entire world, because they were the best people. And, you know, he might have thought he was doing something good for the world. He presented it as being what was going to be best for everybody, and I can see that, you know, to an extent, but they were willing to do anything to make it happen. That's the problem.
Well, if it said the European peoples, then maybe. But the problem is saying just the British. There's too many other European peoples which are equal, and you're going to come into conflict with them, and you're going to end up with
Well,
nothing.
They did, and they didn't care either, because they thought it had to be British. It had to be British and English-speaking. So this thing wasn't too well thought out, I guess. And the Boers caught Jameson, you know, and had him in chains and so on, walking along, and that was the end of that. But then that wasn't the end of it, because then they started out again. So it was at this time when this raid failed
Wilhelm sent
his telegram, right?
That's right, and it was big news, because if you think of the papers today, they still have a large impression on most people. But if you imagine 100 years ago or more, the papers was it. I mean, that was your information, you know?
That's right.
Even before radio, so...
That's right, and the British press was probably the most powerful press in the world, plus... They loved sensationalism and even scandal mongering and so on. The British press still does that. You know, you have the idea of the Times of London, you know, and all very dignified and so on. Then you have go down to these scandal sheets like the Daily Mirror and things like that. Well, I guess they always had that. So Britain always had a very lively press, and from one end to the other, and it was very, very influential. But so, the German press, it says, that applauded this telegram, but then eventually, it, because it had such a negative effect on British German relations, that they started to blame
and distance
the Kaiser for being being impetuous. And well, then he had a, then Queen Victoria got into it, and she was trying to be conciliatory. Well, he, Wilhelm was trying to be conciliatory, but Queen Victoria wrote to him probably something like, "Oh, Willie, my dear little Willie, how could
that's
you
right,
do such
yeah.
a thing?" You know, that's the way
he
talked.
He wrote back and says, "I mean, no offense, and it wasn't
that's
really
right.
my
he,
idea."
He apologized in a sense. He said,
it's pretty minor when you're a blood relation, this kind of thing happening in South Africa. But it's one of the things, I think, that built up, like what we're talking about. It wasn't just a Belgian neutrality and Archduke Ferdinand. You had all these things building up over the years, you see.
Well, yeah, because that turned, that turned the British public against Wilhelm, and therefore against Germany. And they all, it was already anti-German, from what I've read. The British tended to be kind of anti-German. I don't know what that is. Do you do they feel that, is it something about competition, or is it
about
it's, family? You know, that sometimes, you know, you feel more, you have more bitter and competitive
like
feelings with your own family members.
Sibling rivalry. If you
right.
think of Germany and Britain as brothers, which they are in many ways,
mm-hmm.
You know, you have these pops at each other. Because there's a magazine which has always been very popular, I don't think it's around now, but it was very popular then, called Punch Magazine, and they would have caricatures and these kind of things, you know, and they would show the Kaiser as a buffoon and an idiot and all this kind of thing, you know, and the Germans wanting to take over the world.
Well, that's probably why the British public had a generally anti-German feeling, because they got that all the time from...
It was like a drip, nurturing, you know.
Right, and then it turned out, you know, around this time and later, that the German public didn't like the British, because maybe they saw all that stuff and they thought the British didn't like them, so they didn't like them back. And everybody's being, you know, loyal and patriotic to their own, and that was a part of the kind of mood that was being built up at the time.
Mm-hmm. So then if you go forward a bit, so I believe it was 1899 to 1902, the Second Boer War, the British sent a certain contingent to put the Boers down, and it was the Rothschilds of London who put up 50% of the financing. That was when I first heard of the name Rothschild, about 10 years
ago. Yeah, now when they say the Rothschilds put up 50% of the financing, does that mean they did it through their bank as a loan to the British Empire?
Loan to the government, yeah.
Yeah, so
you wouldn't think that the British Empire would need it, but a lot of these colonies I've read, they wasn't always prosperous, and it was a big cost to keep all the logistics going, and you wouldn't always get a good return. So it's not like every colony you have makes...
You know, I read somewhere when I was reading all this stuff that that later on was it Bismarck who wanted to give back. He didn't like the German colonies. He wanted to get rid of them. He wanted to give them back to whoever ever wanted them, and said, "Please take it over because it's expensive and it doesn't do anything for us."
That's right. It's a lot of prestige kind of thing, and Bismarck was not an imperialist, and he kind of surmised that these colonies are more trouble than they're worth.
Yeah, that's exactly what he was saying.
He concentrated on getting German engineering going, and I read a quote in a textbook that, what was it, in the 1890s or something, there was more technical engineering colleges in Munich than the whole of Britain.
Wow.
Yeah, that's the extent that he put into that. We don't need all these colonies. We can ourselves, you know.
Yes, well, that's the thing about royalty, too, which we're going to find. They get into all their royal competitions and so on, and it's just stupid and doesn't help the people at all. Mm. Bismarck was thinking about the people and the nation, he was pretty good. He eventually got sacked by Wilhelm.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay, well, continue. I know you've got this story now, the Second World War.
Yes, the British, which was mostly Irish troops, suffered quite badly when they tried to take over the Transvaal.
So they got the Irish to go down there.
Oh, they're sending Irish in. Yeah. And that was when the British changed from the red coat to the khaki, because they was getting so badly popped off by the Boer commandos, they had to change the colours because the red was sticking out too much. It was not like fighting the Zulus, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then Krupp from Germany was sending armaments for the order of Kaiser Wilhelm to help the Boers, because a lot of them were German. And he thought, well, it's not very fair, this whole empire attacking these small people, I'm going to send them some armaments. And Spion Kop, the British bled so bad at Spion Kop, Birmingham City Football Club has got a stand called the Kop, and it's named after Spion Kop. It was, the British Army had never been lost so many men. Altogether, the British Army lost 40,000 men, which would be nothing compared to the World War One. But at the time, the British Army was not used to losing that kind of men.
Yeah.
That was a big deal. And what really got on the British nerves was some of the cannons and artillery that the Boers had could outrange the British. I think it was a mile. They could shoot for a whole mile, which would outrange the British. And they didn't expect that. They expected it to be pretty easy, you know, we're going to crush these people, you know, but we've crushed people in India, we've crushed people in Africa, the Zulus and stuff, and it didn't work like that against the Boers. Eventually they sent in Kitchener, you know, Lord Kitchener from the famous poster We Want You,
mm-hmm.
the big motorcycle moustache, and he spent huge amounts of money building blockhouses all across the Boer territory. So it became to the stage, we're not going to bother fighting battles, we're going to build these blockhouses with guards all across, and they would use Indians and stuff against these white Boers all across the land, so they can't do anything. So when they blocked them all in, and then they took to burning the farms of Boer women folk who would shelter, you know, the commandos and give them some food and resupply. So they knew that was happening, so they started burning the farms, treating them like niggers, which would be the language they would use at the time, you know. And it eventually led to concentration camps where, I don't know the number, but it was in the tens of thousands, women and children died. So it got to the stage where even though you had great leaders like De Lorraine and Jan Smuts, they was holding their own against the multi-British Empire, but how can you ask a man to continue fighting when his farm has been burnt and he doesn't know where his women and children are? They're in some camp. You
right.
Can't.
They say, I know it was a huge number of even children, Boer children who died.
Yes.
I think I read previously it was 20,000 children.
Oh, at least it was in the tens of thousands. It was the same thing with World War II, with the type, yeah. You know, the epidemics. That's what they
yeah.
was all dying of, because
so
there's too many people close together.
Yeah, and that it was these concentration camps that finally caused the Boers to surrender, because they didn't know what they were fighting for anymore. Their women, like you said, their women and children were dying, were in these camps, and their farms were gone, They had kept fighting, but they finally quit, and that's how they lost.
That's right.
It's a terrible thing.
And the strange thing is, you mentioned Alfred Milner. Now, the book, I can't remember, I don't still have it, but it's a very good book about the Boer War that I read, and his idea all along, he was a super-imperialist. He used to talk about...
Oh, yes. He started being a follower and joined Cecil Rhodes' inner circle of this secret takeover the world group, and he became the leader because he was the strongest, most influential, and most fanatic of all.
He was a fanatic.
Yeah.
like an English racist. I mean, not just against blacks, but against anyone who's not English, anyone. And he had real big plans. He wanted to build a railway from South Africa to Egypt and all these kind of things. And he wanted to populate South Africa with British. What he couldn't understand was, after the Boers were defeated, it never happened. The Afrikaners was never colonised in numbers, like Australia or Canada. That never happened, and he couldn't work out why. And he died on his deathbed. He ironically got bit by a mosquito and died in South Africa.
Wow.
What he never figured out was, it was never really about that. They didn't really want South Africa, the British didn't. They wanted the mines, they wanted the diamonds and the gold. That was all.
That's
and
right.
He wanted it to make a New England in the sun in South Africa, but that was never the intention. That's why it never happened.
Yeah, and that shows you have to see the Jewish influence in there. Because, you know, that's what they always want. They want the money. That's what Cecil Rhodes' organization there was all about. But I think he did sincerely have his plans for making his world safe for the British, you know, colonizing all over the place and putting them in
English architecture.
Yeah, and all that. Kind of, and Milner was a part of that. I think they did think that. But look at how
astray.
It turned out.
Yeah, they were led astray. It was never about that.
Okay. Well, we know that. So
the good thing is that the Afrikaners did eventually get their kind of their own autonomy back, didn't they? And that's when, I don't know the years, I think it was maybe 1948 or something, when they had their racial policies, which separated whites and blacks. Because if you remember, I read a bit earlier, the English or the British was already giving the blacks more rights in the 1800s. And, that was never what the Afrikaners was about. And they made it clear, you know, we're not going to live together. You can live in the same country and we'll give you work and education, but no race mixing. And so the Afrikaners did do okay in the end, up till, when was it? 1990 or something, when they lost their country to the ANC.
Well, it's all horrendous. You know, when you study, when you really find out the history of any of these things, you start to lose faith in just about everybody, because human nature and people are just it's just so susceptible to being undermined, and I don't want to even use the real words. I just want to call them, you know, I want to just say we're so scummy, just scum, mm-hmm. You know. What all this talk about white honor and white racial this, that, and the other thing, at bottom, where do you find it? I mean, there's certain people, certain things have come about, but the rotten stuff seems to always win out. And these are white people who are cooperating with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think from what I can tell, and I know it sounds a bit conspiratorial, but the British Empire was not the British Empire after the Battle of Waterloo, when the Rothschilds brought up all the stocks, because it was at that point, you see, go away from being a racial empire to being just total hyper-capitalism to please shareholders. It was all about shareholders, you know.
Well, I could agree with that. I mean, I could see that. That doesn't sound too conspiratorial to me, because my overall question I wanted to bring up today, so you've already started answering or haven't answered it, is how did Britain get so controlled by Jews, and how did it get so much like Jews, and how did they just get so ruthless and corrupt and so on? What happened? And you're saying it was Battle of Waterloo.
Yeah, because as the history goes, the Rothschilds sent an agent to observe the battle, and he saw that Napoleon had lost, and he sent a carrier pigeon over to the Rothschilds in London and told them, and then he went to the stock exchange and said Napoleon had won. So that caused the panic, and everyone started selling all their shares. And meanwhile, he was smiling, waiting for it to go low, 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 and then brought up all the shares for pennies. And then when the truth came out that the British had won, people regretted selling their shares, but it was too late.
Right, and then what happens, and what I brought up earlier, Paul, is that in human nature, we somehow can't help but admire the people who come out ahead like that, no matter how rotten it is.
Mm.
You know, Hitler talks about this.
Doesn't Hitler talk about abolishing the stock exchange in Mein Kampf? As it's all, you know, usury and slavery.
I don't know for sure, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah.
I need to read Mein Kampf again. I read it so long ago that I don't remember it well enough. I remember, but I don't remember all those details.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm reading Table Talk, so I won't be reading Mein Kampf for a while. This is when we forget to blame these people for what they did, and we start to admire them. And they have all these ways of changing their names and fitting in and looking like us and so on. And then, you know, we just forget that they're not. So I think something else I was thinking of about that. I brought that up before. I guess I already said that. Well, I don't know. There was something else, but I've forgotten it now. This is very good. I'm getting some real answers here. This is good.
Yeah, I think that's what makes us socialists, i.e. national socialists, is that that's the one thing we do agree with them with, is the all this kind of usury and the stock markets and all this kind of thing, and the interest and the fractional reserve banking. We agree with them on that, but we are national socialists where they, meaning the far left, are international socialists. Well, we agree with borders and race and nation, and they don't. That's the big difference.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Well, I go along with that too, Paul. So, all right, we are just about at our 1 hour mark. Did you want to take a break? Would you like me to play a little 3 minutes of music to take a little break, or just want to keep going?
Oh, yes, please. I'd like a break.
Okay. Well, I'm going to play, all I've got here is Willie Fritsch singing Lily Marlene. He's the male voice singing it. I like his version of it. So I'll play that, and it is exactly 2 minutes and 54 seconds, and then we'll
okay.
be back. Okay.
Bye-bye. See you in a minute.
Der Kaserne vor dem großen Tor stand eine Laterne und steht sie noch davor. So wollen wir uns da wiedersehen, bei der Laterne wollen wir stehen, wie ein Lili Marlene, wie ein Lili Marlene. Unsere beiden Schatten sahen wie eine Raut, dass wir so lieb uns hatten, das sah man gleich heraus. Und alle Leute sollen es sehen, wenn wir bei der Laterne stehen, wie ein Lili Marlene, wie ein Lili Marlene. Schon rief der Posten, die Blasenzapfen streich, das kann 3 Tage kosten, am Rathen komm sogleich. Da sagten wir auf Wiedersehen, wie gerne wollt ich mit dir gehen, mit dir, Lili Marlene, mit dir, Lili Marlene. Deine Schritte kennt doch nicht ergab sie lang. Und sollte mir ein Leid geschehen, wer wird bei der Laterne stehen? Mit dir, Lili Marlene, mit dir, Lili Marlene. Aus dem stillen Raume, auf der Erde Grund, Hebt mich wie im Traume dein verliebter Mund, wenn sich die späten Nebel drehen, werd ich bei der Laterne stehen, wie einst Marlene, wie einst Lili.
And so we're back, ladies and gentlemen, and this is Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn Yeager. I am Carolyn, and my guest is Paul Hickman. Are you there, Paul? Paul's not quite back yet.
I'm back. I had the mute button on again. I do that every time.
Yeah, I know about that. So I may have been making noise here while this music was playing. I don't know. I forgot about that myself. So, I was going to tell the people that we're talking about World War I, this being the 100th anniversary year of the start of the war in 1914. And I think it's going very well, talking about some of the tensions that were coming together to make a war between these European powers more and more probable. And I remembered while we were gone, Paul, I'm having a little hiccups now. Just drank some water, and that's why. I remembered that what I was going to say, when you talked about the Battle of Waterloo and the Rothschilds buying up all those shares and making, you know, millions or billions or something, and that being when Britain no longer was the same British establishment that it had been. And I was going to say that I think the same thing happened in the United States, and I don't know what the date would be or what the time or the event would be when that happened, but it could be maybe at the end of the Civil War, or maybe the beginning of the Civil War or during the Civil War, but
yes,
it may be that event that changed the United States too and was never the same.
I think you're
again.
Exactly right, Carolyn. There's a really good documentary. It's over an hour long, called The Secret of Oz. And it's about all that kind of stuff, and the greenbacks, and I think, was it Abraham Lincoln who wanted to reinstall the greenbacks, I think, which was cutting out the Federal Reserve, and he got assassinated. And then later on you had Kennedy, who had talked about cutting out the Federal Reserve, and he got assassinated. So that's true.
Shows you how vicious it is. I mean, this is serious stuff, and you don't go against that. Although, but it depends on who has the power and who doesn't. Paul, his last name is Paul. What's his first name? Ron Paul.
Yes.
Ron Paul talked about it a lot, but they didn't bother him because he didn't have any chance in heck, I guess, of doing it. So.
That's right, and I think he had a bit of a. He didn't go the whole hog, as I understand it. He talked about the gold reserve and stuff. I don't think he was going to go the whole hog, but. He was making those overtures. But it's funny we're talking about these dates. So I believe it was in 1913 when the Federal Reserve was brought into being. So.
Well, that's right. That's a whole other part of this.
That's got to be connected, hasn't it?
Or sure it is. Okay. Well, let's stick with this. This along these lines, and what I've got next is talking about Wilhelm II, and his personality and what part he played. In causing all these tensions. Okay, and now you've said some things about him. Do you want to say some more before I go into some of my detail about the relationship between he and Edward VII?
Yes, I've got a few notes on the timeline of Wilhelm.
Okay.
He had a troubled birth. His English mother, Vicky, was Queen Victoria's eldest daughter, as we mentioned. Complications during birth, it was a breech position, and the doctor had to break his arm to deliver him as a baby, and it affected his nerves in his arm and his neck, and that's why he had a withered arm, which it was hard for his mother to reconcile, because people with disabilities in those days, especially royal people, it was a big deal. Later on, his neck was going to one side, and they even operated. They put him in a brace at first, a really archaic kind of brace, and that didn't work. So they performed surgery and took some tendons out of his neck to keep his neck straight. So he had a tough start.
And I read about that part too, Paul. That his arm that was affected was 6 inches shorter than the other arm.
Yes.
And then he always tries to hide that in photographs and so on, one way or another.
Yeah, and you can understand that. And,
sure. It would look funny if he just said it was two arms hanging down straight. You'd be very noticeable, 6 inches.
So when you had these posh meals, these royals would come, and as he was maturing into a man, he couldn't even cut his own meat. He had to have the person next to him do it because he didn't have the strength in his arm. And you know how those rules were. You had to use a certain hand for your cutting with the knife and a certain hand for your fork. And you couldn't just swap them around because you had a withered arm. That's how, you know, I suppose you'll say anal now, but that's how official it all was. Eventually, he had a special kind of contraption made, which was a knife and a fork combined. But anyway...
Wow, I didn't read any of that, but I did read that that he had trouble riding on a horse, and even as a little kid, you know, they start him real young because, like you say, speaking about what they think is important, being able to be a horseman is totally necessary, and his mother, Vicky, especially, insisted that he had to be able to sit on a horse properly, and he kept falling off. And he called it torture, and he resented her for the rest of his life because of what he went through. And they just they'd set him on there, and he'd start off. I guess it had to do with his arm, and he would lose his balance.
Yeah, yeah.
Balance. He'd fall off the horse, and they'd put him right back on again, and that's what they did over and over again. He said it was absolutely torture, but he finally figured out. I guess he realized they weren't going to stop. So he had to use his wits, and he finally figured out how to do it, how to make the adjustment. So, and
yes.
I guess he was a good enough horseman.
He was. He was very good academically, and despite his disability, he learned to swim, shoot, and ride horses. So in 1871, he witnessed the unification of Germany as a young boy, and he became very nationalistic, German nationalist at that age. At 1888, his father was Kaiser for only a few months due to cancer of the larynx, and he's supposedly quite a weak man. There was 3 Kaisers in that year. There was his grandfather, Wilhelm I, who was the first one.
Who he was close to, they say.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And he died, and then his father was only Kaiser for, I think, 99 days, and he died of the cancer. So then he was made Emperor of Germany, Kaiser Wilhelm, at the age of 29. And Queen Victoria always liked him. She called him Little Willie. He was her oldest grandson. And Wilhelm was very fond of visiting Osborne and the Isle of Wight as a child. He was a very competitive boy, but he never got on with the Prince of Wales, who you mentioned, who was the future King of England, Edward VII. Queen Victoria made him the Admiral of the British Navy, kind of an honorary Admiral,
right,
which he was very proud of. And he became very impressed with the Royal Navy to the point of obsession. 1897, Wilhelm starts a massive naval building program in Germany, and he says Germany is entitled to a place in the sun. 1901, Wilhelm rushed to Osborne in England when he heard of Queen Victoria dying, and so the story goes, she is said to have died in his arms. They was very close. During the funeral of Queen Victoria, the Kaiser was there on his horse, and the British applauded him, and they liked him at that stage. But Wilhelm had his own personality. He enjoyed pranks and had a juvenile sense of humour. There's a story where he was on one of these flagships, and all the top brass was there, and some of them would be seasick. So he went up to one, punched him in the belly, and says, "Any minute now." And then this high-ranking admiral threw up over the side. He thought that was a hoot.
I never read that. Where did you get that?
Yeah, he's I can't remember exactly, but there's a lot of stuff about his personality. He was a bit of a joker, you know.
I guess what I read was moderated to make him sound not that bad.
He was impish, but it's no harm, you know. I mean, he's the Emperor of Germany. If the Emperor of Germany wants to make a joke, he makes a joke, you know. But a lot was made out of that. They said he's not professional. He's not. He shouldn't be this. He's, you know, he's a fool. But he wasn't a fool. He was very keen in archaeology. He wrote a book on archaeology. He went down to Crete, and it was from the white perspective. He would look for ancient Aryans, the Minoans, and stuff like that. He was perfectly capable academically, but he was often left out of raw get-togethers. They would all get together in Denmark. I can't remember the name, but there's some holiday retreat, and you see all these photos of all the royals, and including other German royalty, Swedish, Danish, even Greeks, and one person missing was Kaiser Wilhelm, and there's photographs of them all together, and you'll see him all the way on the side. You know, like a wedding photo with an unpopular relative?
Yeah.
That's where he would be. But it's like, you know, this is the Emperor of Germany, really. He should have been at the front, you know?
Right.
And this got worse after Victoria died, because she died early 1900s, and it got a lot worse after that. And so 1906, Eulenburg was accused of homosexuality and put on trial. Philipp Eulenburg was a Prussian politician and diplomat and very close friend of Kaiser Wilhelm. Although Eulenburg had 8 children, and his name was never cleared, he got sick, very sick, before the trial, and he never managed to clear his name. So his enemies, people used this against Wilhelm, and the rumour was put around that he was a homosexual, even though he had a wife and 7 children, and 2 illegitimate children. Wilhelm could never speak to Eulenburg again. 1912, you have problems internal in Germany, as well as everything else going on internationally, because the socialists became the main party in the Reichstag. So the socialists, the far left, was always busy in Germany, very anti-monarchist. As recent as 1914, in Kiel, the British Navy visit Germany on a friendly mission, and the Kaiser is still the admiral of the British fleet. And they're all getting along jolly, you know, and they have the parties and all this kind of thing. And it was at this time that the news of the assassination in Sarajevo of Franz Josef comes in, and the Anglo-British get-together is abruptly ended, and they sail off. And so that's what I have about him. He's a very flamboyant character. He was he liked to make fun and stuff, but he was also fiercely nationalistic, and he liked England, but he believed that Germany had proved themselves to be equal to England and should be treated as such, and as head of state, he should be given all the honours of the head of state, as Victoria had done, made him an admiral, because he remarked, what a fine day to wear the uniform of Nelson. Because he could wear a British Navy uniform. But when she went, he was always pushed out the picture, and it was a real shame, really.
Well, that's it. And what I read, I got the impression that I got was that that I have from what I read was that he was he loved England, he loved Britain, he loved the British, and he recognized them as his family, but he also loved Germany, and he really truly did love Germany and his people there, and but he knew he was the, like you said, the Emperor of Germany, and so that's what he needed to look after their interests. But he was accused of being too pro-British by they say the German people. So just in a general, you know, a general feeling amongst the German people was that maybe they're Kaiser was too pro-British, because they were not pro-British from what I've read. That was great, Paul. That was great, and lots of funny stories I'd never heard. But what I've got here is his relationship with Edward VII, and I came upon something written by Christopher M. Bartone. It's a PDF. So something Ohio EDU paper, but I think he wrote it for his PhD dissertation or something. But anyway, I'm not sure. But anyway, the point he's making is that the royal family relationships had a whole lot more to do with World War One than historians ever want to think that it did, you know, and that he goes into it is pretty interesting anyway. And again, you've told all about his relationship with Queen Victoria and so on and her feelings toward him. But her son, Edward, who became Edward the VII, he was the uncle of Wilhelm. Wilhelm was her grandson. So he was older, but he took the throne a lot later than Wilhelm did because, of course, Victoria lived to be a pretty ripe old age, and he had to wait for that before he got on the throne. And while he was growing up in the royal household, and Wilhelm came to visit often, you know, he visited his granny, the queen, a couple of times a year and so on. So he was, you know, they were all very, just like any family, they, you know, called each other by their nicknames, and they were just very ordinary amongst one another and had the usual likes and dislikes probably, and the feelings that you get that you're not given as much attention as somebody else and all that stuff that goes on in families. There was all these royals of Europe at the time were all connected family-wise, but particularly between the British and the Germans, who were really, really connected together.
And the Jews could never be part of that, could they?
No, that's right. They weren't part of that.
But they really resented that.
Yeah. So, but Edward the VII didn't have the approval of Victoria because he was kind of a wastrel. I mean, he was pretty bad in the way that he liked to drink a lot. As he got a little older, he became a big drinker, partier, gambler, and a womanizer. And he did all these kind of things. But yet, in the royal system there, nobody ever thought to say, well, he's not going to be the next king. He's not worthy enough. No, he was allowed to do all that stuff, and they try to cover it up. You know how they do. And he was still not, there's no question, I guess, that he was going to be king eventually, and they thought he'd settle down. But he continued. He liked France. He developed a real preference for France and Paris, and he spent time in Paris. Of course, he had plenty of money, and then he came into his becoming the Prince of Wales and all this stuff. You keep adding to your holdings, your land and all the money, your income and so on. So he just led that kind of a life. And it was full of scandal. While Wilhelm was this kind of the good boy, the good little boy, you know, and he was instructed at an early age on how to be a royal, and he did his thing there in Germany, and he was pretty serious about it, and he thought pretty highly of himself, it said. But Edward just didn't care. He just told people, you know, it's like no matter what criticism he got, he didn't like it, but he wasn't going to change any, and he didn't care. So there is this kind of a thing between these two men that this author seems to goes into. And he says
he would antagonize Wilhelm a lot, and he wouldn't treat him like you're supposed to treat a nephew, as friendly and give him advice. And
right, he was kind of a mean streak. But
cold
he was
shoulder.
Cold shoulder, but he was good at covering it up and then blaming it onto Wilhelm. And Wilhelm, because he was kind of impetuous, and Wilhelm did have these feelings, as you were describing so well, he couldn't avoid having these feelings and being resentful at the way he was being treated. And then he'd try not to show it and, you know, try to act cavalier and so on. And then it would come out and he would show it. And so it was difficult for him. But I agree that I think he seems like a pretty good guy, but it's not like he was perfect. I don't agree with those pranks he was pulling. That seems pretty childish.
They're little stories. I mean, I presume they're true, but he was known to have like a childish, prankish streak. Well, I think that's endearing myself.
Okay. Well, then in 1888 to 1900, I'll just start here, there was a paradigm shift, and At that, up till then, Germany was content to let Great Britain take the lead in international crises, and things were going along pretty well. But Britain, Germany, and Italy signed the League of Peace, intended to curb the French and the Russians from their desire to expand into the Mediterranean Sea. And so this is what was going on. But then Edward took the throne in 1901. And Wilhelm had begun pulling away from Britain before that, you know, and establishing Germany more, establishing himself as a German ruler more strongly, maybe. And then the king, King Edward, pushed him further away through his own policies based on his own Germanophobia and dislike of the Kaiser. And, yeah, you know, when he, they were saying that when he was in... He liked Paris, and he liked the French, and he liked the French ways and so on. And when he met Napoleon III, he supposedly, here's a story, said to him, I wish you were my father. he was very, very...
Well, isn't that funny? Because it was the Prussians, basically, who made Britain get that victory, because without the Prussians helping, Napoleon might have beat them. So... France was not an ally, not long before.
He just liked their ways better, and they were more. He didn't like the strictness in the Victorian era type of, you know, behavior in Britain and in Germany, where everything was more conservative.
There was a bit of a craze around that time in England. I've read for everything French for the the
probably came from him. He probably influenced it. Then Wilhelm dismissed Bismarck and. He instituted a new course in foreign policy, according to this, and he was trying to get along with his uncle, and he, at a banquet in his uncle's honor, he suggested that together the British fleet and the German army would ensure the peace of the world. Mm. So, he had that idea that the German army would be strong and they'd let the British have the sea. The British made some tried to make some treaties with Germany, but Wilhelm thought that they were just things to get control, and he was suspicious about British motivations. And he wrote to Nicholas II, and Nicholas, well, we're not going to have time for the rest of this if I do all this, so I better not do any more.
Nicholas was his cousin, right?
Yeah, Nicholas was the cousin of both of them.
Mm.
He wrote that England has still now and then reopened negotiations with us, but has never quite uncovered its hand. They are trying hard, as far as I can make out, to find a continental army to fight for their interests. Well, Wilhelm was no dummy then, because this is what Hitler was always saying, that the British wanted to get others to fight for them. Again, they were probably had learned that from the Jews by then.
Yes. And I know that the, I don't know if you came across the French in the 1900s before the First World War, they gave a massive amount of money to the Russians to upgrade their railways. And the reason to do that was so they could fight Germany better. No other reason. But,
he wasn't
daft in seeing that what's going on of
Western... He was trying real hard to get along, but he had enough sense to be suspicious of a lot of these things. And under William VII, he was king. Edward. Yeah, thank you, Edward VII. He in 1902, he is the one who visited in Japan, and he ended up getting a formal treaty of alliance with Japan, which he was very proud of. And then he visited Paris in 1903, and he wanted to get something going with France. And he ended up getting what was called the Entente Cordiale in 1904 with France, which was a colonial treaty. But for all intents and purposes, the Entente had the effect of removing all potential sources of friction between the two countries and eliminating the possibilities for further German colonial acquisitions in Africa, since Britain and France were now unlikely to look the other way if Germany made more moves. Or made moves into one another's territory. And this thing with Japan concerned with defending India from Russia. So he thought that having this friendship with Japan. It would help keep Russia in line. So he was busy doing all this. He was no dummy either, but he knew what he was doing. And he thought that this entente with France was his crowning achievement, his diplomatic masterpiece.
Huh.
And so see, how can I finish this up here? I've said a lot of this stuff already.
Well, that shows the lack of racial unity, doesn't it? Making alliances with Japan and shunning Germany.
Yeah, well, I don't think they were concerned with that.
The British never seemed to think that the dark races would ever get anywhere, would ever evolve, it seems, whereas the Germany and the Kaiser understood that they would, because the Kaiser, Wilhelm II, coined the term yellow peril. He warned about the Chinese. He says, one day these people are going to start taking over. And I mentioned Savile Row earlier, that invented suits in Britain, and I was reading an article just today, and they says that the Chinese are buying it up. They're not only buying all the cars, they're buying all these cultural things like that as well. So he foresaw that. He saw these things.
I think that's a weak point in the British, in that they just like they thought their empire could never go away or nothing could happen to it.
Yeah.
They seem to think that they're invulnerable or invincible. So so Germany is more conservative. Russia was more conservative. The French were more liberal. And the Germans looked upon the British as too liberal. That's one thing at this time. Mm. They're too liberal. So so now we come to where Nicholas gets in on it, and he's concerned about his, you know, his ambitions and his the for Russia. And so they're all the conclusion is that. Edward VII died on 6 May 1910, and without resolving his feud with his nephew. And he wrote this of Wilhelm: "That fellow is foolish enough and insane enough to fight for the mastery of Europe, and to involve England among his enemies in the conflict, because he suffers from the delusion that he understands the English people better than anyone else in Europe." See, I don't think any of that is true. I think Edward's just saying that. That's the way he would attack Wilhelm. But that doesn't seem to fit what he was doing.
Spiteful comments.
Yeah, right. And let's see. It kind of, in essence, it was like what Edward's relationship with Wilhelm was that Edward... As they bring up that Victoria always made everybody understand that she was the head of the family. She was the senior person in the family, so she could say what everybody else had to kind of follow along with, because she had this seniority. Well, then Edward pulled that seniority on Wilhelm, and then Wilhelm resented it because Edward was older and was going to be the king of England, he had been emperor. He had been emperor of Germany longer than.
Yeah. So he had some rank,
but he was always treated like he didn't have any. And so I said Edward would put Wilhelm in his place once and for all. That's what Edward was, you know, and these underlying feeling family feud type things. Edward was always trying to put Wilhelm in his place and make himself, you know, the more important one. And when George V took the throne, he wasn't very active, but he didn't like Germany all that much, but he had good relations with Nicholas in Russia, and then they all got together all the time, and like a private club in the summers and so on, and they would sometimes exclude Wilhelm from this club, as you said, and he knew it and he resented it, so there are all these resentments going on in this family, which I don't think. Thinking about all this, that it's a good idea to have all these related families ruling. At this time, they were real rulers. You know, they did have ministers and they had constitutions and so on, but they still had a lot of. They were considered, you know, people that made decisions and so on. So, it was not a good idea to have Europe all intermingled like this. You could maybe think that, well, they're all the same family, they'll all try to get along, but that's not how families work, is it?
Yeah, that's
families
right.
Families can be the most, you can hate, you know, you reserve your strongest feelings for members of your own family, really, mm-hmm. for the most part. Either you love them very much, or you hate them very much, or they don't mean much to you, one way or the other or something, but... So, okay, well, I'm not going to go any further on that, but I think that there's a lot to that, because Wilhelm is always blamed for being part of the cause of the war.
Yeah, I think that's unjust.
Yes, when you look into it, you find out that it is. So now the Berlin-Baghdad Railway is another factor. Did you say
can I,
that...
Can I read a bit about that?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, so it's a... probable cause for World War One, or at least a strong factor, I would say. There is a PDF of an essay called "The Berlin-Baghdad Railway as a Cause of World War One," and it's by Arthur P. Maloney, 1959. He writes, "In this paper, I trace the history of the Baghdad Railway from its conception in 1888 to the beginning of World War One. I will show how important the railway was in the political, economic and diplomatic events which led to the First World War. By 1912, Germany's visible trade had increased from one half that of England's, in those days, let's say England, that means Britain, from one half that of England in 1887 to almost equal that of England in 1912, despite a doubling of English trade in that period. So even though England's trade had doubled, the Germany was still catching up. Page 10, Maloney writes, as early as 1835, Moltke, who had served as military advisor in Turkey, suggested German development of the area. Subsequently, in 1871, von Pressel made certain surveys which impressed the Turkish government, and a short railway was built. It was not, however, until 1888 that the Baghdad project can be said to have begun. In that year, Dr. Siemens, Deutsche Bank, founded the Anatolian Railway Company, Anatolia, old name for Turkey. The new company took over an existing British line and began to extend it into southern Anatolia. Including in the concession was an agreement by the Anatolian Railway to consider extension to Baghdad at some subsequent date. Page 11. First, the Russians objected to the line going through Angora as being a potential threat to her interests in eastern Anatolia. By the Black Sea Basin Agreement of 1899, the route was shifted westwards, and Russia withdrew her objections. So that's Russia out of the way. Second, the British, fearing the possibility of a German naval base on the Persian Gulf, made a protectorate out of Kuwait, by agreement with the Sheikh of Kuwait in 1899. The result was that Basra, 60 miles north of the Gulf, became the proposed terminus. Interesting though, Basra was what the British was in control of during the Iraq War with Saddam. Continued, the line as projected therefore ran from Constantinople, modern-day Istanbul, to Basra, a distance of 2,500 miles. This was a project of greater magnitude than the Santa Fe from Chicago to Los Angeles or the Union Pacific from Omaha to San Francisco. End quote. So again, you have Britain trying to check Germany having overseas interests, although Britain had a third of the world already to deal with. And bear in mind, oil hadn't been discovered in the region at this time, and Britain was soon, but had not yet, switched from coal to oil. So even without that, the British didn't want this to happen. Page 12, sorry.
Okay, I was going to ask you what page you're on. You're on page 12
yep.
now? Okay.
Page 12. The British and the French governments continued to obstruct the railway. In addition to blocking Germany from access to the British and French securities market, that's banking stuff again, I don't understand all the ins and outs, but you get the point, Britain put pressure on the Turks to slow down the railway. Taken altogether, these policies, Maloney comments, of France and England, and to a certain extent Russia, constituted a most determined and consistent opposition. Yet, Soroli and Fraser, writing in 1912, derided German talk of Entente opposition to the railway. This type of journalism could not and did not contribute to a better international atmosphere. page 17. Now, was the railway important to diplomacy or was it not? Maloney asks. Was it important or was it not? Was it just a footnote, a pawn, a minor irritant? The answer is no. Page 19. In summing up, the railway was a manifestation of a dramatic and alarming growth of German economic power. It played a role in the British-German trade rivalry, in their strategic manoeuvrings, and in the German-English press controversies. The railway helped unite the Entente powers against Germany, and this led Germany into a fear of encirclement. Her increasing involvement in the Balkans and her dangerous alliance with Austria. I don't know why the alliance was dangerous, but...
Well, to them.
Yeah.
To who are we talking about here?
Well, this guy Maloney is British, but he seems to be very sympathetic to the Germans. Maybe leave that. He continues, as Mill says in his The Causes of World War III, that is the correct title, The Causes of World War III, allowing sources of national conflicts to grow without attending to them is to court disaster. The railway involved a major conflict of national interests. Failure to estimate these sources of conflict correctly on both German and Entente sides definitely helped bring on World War I. That's end quote from Maloney in 1959.
Yeah, so this was just, to me, kind of an aspect of this economic competition that was going on. And Germany was involved in building this railway, as I understand it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was getting freaked out over what it would mean to them at this place or at that place and another place. Thinking that Germany was trying to do this for its own benefit to get some advantage. It's as though these people all think they should be acting in their own interest to get an advantage, but as soon as Germany acts in their own interest, that's evil of them and wrong. Am I being too sensitive?
That's how it seems, yeah. I mean, you would think... if it was like a racial empire, which the British Empire was at one stage, they would think, oh, well, our German brothers in Turkey or Anatolia are doing something good. They're expanding our race's interest in this part of the world. We can't do everything. We've got Canada, Australia, New Zealand, India, Africa. You know, well, good for them. But they didn't see it that way. It's like, well, we're not having that. We'll make a protectorate out of Kuwait just to stop a railway. I mean...
Yeah, yeah. So, but these people weren't... I don't know where you get the idea that you said if they were thinking racially. Well, they weren't thinking racially.
No.
They thought that Europeans, including the Russian Empire, were the great powers of the world, and therefore their competitors were amongst these European nations.
Mm. Yeah, it's this it's this kind of pig-headed belief that the English was probably more racist than the Germans, if you think about it, because they believed that the nigger, and they used to use that word all the time, the niggers would never, ever do anything. Where Germany realises that times are changing, technology is spreading, and these Turks, we can work with these Turks. They're not as advanced as we are. They can't build their own railway. But we can benefit here and, get some...
Yeah, it was all about trade too, wasn't it? I mean, you had to have somebody to trade with.
Yes, whereas with the British, it was like, well, we've got to do everything and, nobody else can be involved. Because the Germans, I've read, used to make a big effort to learn different languages. For their colonies, they would learn the local dialects and stuff. Whereas the British wouldn't bother and just, if they're too thick to speak English, then we're not gonna talk to them kind of thing, which on that way, if you're like that, you can't learn what's happening on the ground. Whereas if you learn the dialect and stuff, you can get more involved at a local level. And I think that's one of the things Germany was doing that Britain wasn't.
Okay, well, I don't really... I'm going to close this page. I don't really have anything to add to that. So,
what I would add was oil was suddenly so important, like this link I sent you, due to cars, planes, diesel engines for trains and ships, all requiring oil, because not that long before it was steam or coal. And the powers that declared war on Germany in World War I, I think, reasoned they must stop German expansion by depriving her of oil. Because a modern army, as you know, can't fight without oil, just like the Americans did to Japan, embargoed oil. Now, the Baghdad Railway would have secured oil for Germany and her ally, the Ottomans. Although I used to be a bit confused, why did Germany ally with the Ottomans? But this kind of explains it. So I guess that was their thinking. And also, if you're going to talk about the hide, you know, the hand behind these leaders, this railway, which never happened in the end, it never got finished, but if it had, it would have also broken up the Rockefeller oil cartel in the United States and the Anglo-Dutch Shell cartel, which was controlled by the Rothschilds out of London. So that was probably the main reason.
Oh, that's really big. I mean, that would certainly make them not want this.
And I think vast amounts was discovered in Persia, just next to Basra, you know, about 1908. So
wow.
Germany would have had plenty of oil to fight and export and all that. So then these conglomerates, these cartels, they couldn't have that. So that they will tell their royals or their politicians, sort that railway out. We're not having that. Get rid of it. And
well, I would say the British have always cooperated better with these hand behind the scenes than the Germans did, by far. Germans weren't very good at cooperating with them until after World War II.
Yeah, when they didn't have no choice.
Right.
Because remember I sent you that PDF, which I don't think I've got anymore, but it was saying about the whole Zionism thing. Originally, they wanted to try it through the Germans to get, because there's so many Jews in Germany, that's who they wanted to use to get Palestine to their side. But the Germans played them along, and then they got what they could out of the agreement, and then they said no. Tough luck, and then it was the Jews decided to go to Britain, and we'll get our homeland that way.
Yeah. Okay, so let's move on to the Landman document, and at this time, you know, again, we have the general thing that's always been brought forward, that Germany's industrial output, trade, and their navy too quickly is catching up with Britain, and it caught up in the industrial output and trade. In these years preceding 1914, British policy in Europe intended always that no country in Europe should become completely dominant. That has a name too. They had that policy for a long time. That on the continent, all the countries should be more or less equal, or you know, competing with one another. But they shouldn't. One shouldn't be dominant. When of course Germany was the one that was going to become dominant, and they didn't want that. That was against their long-standing policy. And it became, by 1907, it was becoming clear to Britain that this threat to that was going to be Germany, and they began to support Russia and France at that time. And Britain joined the Triple Entente between Russia and France, and then Britain went ahead and joined up with them. So this was very threatening to Germany. And but even though Britain was part of the Triple Entente, it didn't need to go to war. It wasn't committed to going to war in 1914. But Germany didn't want them to go to war. But they, when the Germans invaded France and Belgium as part of the Schlieffen Plan, Britain didn't have to go to war. But then they decided that they were being threatened somehow by that, and so they did. They declared war on Germany in 1914.
With Britain's navy in 1914, there is no way on earth that Germany could have invaded Britain.
That's right.
Even more so than World War II. So that's like another.
You're right. You're right.
Another excuse.
Yeah. Thanks for adding that.
As if they cared about Belgium. I mean, you know.
Yeah, but anyway, so that's why they did. But then we go to this Landman document, and what it tells us is that in 1929, a Polish writer called Milinski published a book which is very revealing, but very few people, I guess, read it, or not too many people know about it now. And this comes from heretical.com, and you sent it to me.
Oh, good site. And you know the guy who writes that is in jail, I think, at the moment.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah, yeah, the guy from Heretical.
Yeah.
Or, but I heard he was just raided. Did he get out of prison and now they've raided his house again? I was reading something about that.
To check that.
Yeah. But anyway, Simon Shepherd, isn't that?
Yeah, that's the
one of them, and another one. But anyway, this is a good page here. Milinski concluded that that America's entrance into the war was due to the Jewish influence, and this is from his writing. If there had not been the Lusitania affair, the asphyxiating gases, or the intrigues of German and Austrian ambassadors on American territory, in which they were surely not unique, other ways would have been found to achieve the same results. No provocation would have been too severe to obtain them, since democracy was in danger and it urgently needed American intervention to come to its aid. Democracy was in danger, and that was the most important point and indeed the pivot of all contemporary history. The rest is just empty, meaningless phrases, fodder for thrown to the beast, etc. The apparent spontaneity of their enthusiasm for war, it means the Americans, which shook the American people, should not astonish those who know America or who lived there for some years before 1914. For at that time, thousands and thousands of non-Jewish people who had nevertheless been intoxicated by a costly and clever publicity campaign demanded at the tops of their voices that diplomatic and commercial relations should be broken off with the Tsar's government. Now, we read all about this in The International Jew. There's a couple of chapters, you know, that were devoted to this, and so I'm not going to go into anything more about this, but this was a shock to the whole, kind of to the whole world, that America broke off its relations with a certain kind of relations in a certain treaty with Russia based on something that these few Jews wanted. You know, a few Jews wanted it to be done, and they managed to get it done. So that shouldn't surprise people that later on, in 1917, the same man enlisted enthusiastically every soldier. Now let's see that all these Americans signed up to go to Europe, as he says, hundreds of thousands of inhabitants from Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Florida, Illinois, Wyoming, California, and subsequently from Ontario, Manitoba, Rhodesia, and New South Wales, whose only possible motive was to hasten the triumph of democracy, that they went over to France and risked their lives and gave their lives for something called democracy. That's the only thing that was ever sold to them. And so he says that they were persuaded that their greatest privilege was to set out and get themselves killed at the uttermost ends of the earth with no hope of gain for themselves or their children, etc. So anyway, in March 1936, a Zionist Jew named Samuel Landman published a work called Great Britain, the Jews, and Palestine under the auspices of the Zionist Association. And in this book was a confirmation of Milinski's thesis that it was the Zionist Jews who convinced the United States to join the United Kingdom and enter the war. And I guess a prefatory to this is that if it hadn't been for the United States coming into the war, there would not have been the victory for.
It would not have been a treaty of Versailles,
at all. In fact, Germany was set up to win, but then it made a few, I guess, strategic errors or something, and they didn't. They made a last thrust, and they were having other troubles elsewhere, but it failed, and then they lost the advantage, and they started being at a disadvantage. So then they were suing for peace. They were going to sue for peace, and even with America in the war, I know the reason was because America had come into the war. That's why. I'm getting mixed up here. So the United States made all the difference in both of these wars. And in both of these wars, it said that it was the Jews who were turned to, especially by the British, to bring America into the war, and they succeeded.
At the cost of the Balfour Declaration, right?
Yes, as those who assisted at the birth of the Balfour Declaration were few in number. This makes it important to bring into proper relief the services of one who, owing to, above all to his modesty, has hitherto remained in the background. His services, however, should take their proper place in the front rank, I don't know, what am I reading here, alongside Englishmen of vision, and this includes, they list a bunch of Englishmen. In the early days of the war, great efforts were made by the Zionist leaders, Dr. Weizmann and Mr. Sokolow, to through C.P. Snow and the Manchester Guardian and Herbert Samuel, Sir Herbert Samuel, to induce the cabinet to espouse the cause of Zionism. Well, they wouldn't do it. And that's why the Jews came up with this plan that if they would do it, and come up with this, that's where the Balfour Declaration came from. They would convince the Americans to join the war. And
yes,
at that time, you know, Woodrow Wilson was a pacifist still, and they were isolationists, and then he kind of suddenly changed his mind.
Jewish power putting on the pressure, like you covered in Henry Ford's work.
Right.
How much power they had. Because remember that Palestine at this time was a British colony, or at least a protectorate. The British owned it. And the deal was, you help us, and we'll work with you to give you that land. And, you know, unholy, dishonorable arrangement, which they did, and which is causing all the trouble now. And it could lead to World War III. You don't know. I mean, that's what they did to get America into the war. Ludendorff's spring offensive of 1918 was very successful. The French had already mutinied. It was Pétain just about got them to stay in it by giving them all these extra privileges. And the British was really badly beat. There was 58,000 on the first day of the Somme. And the Germans had got Russia out of the war by sending Lenin in to foment revolution, so they had 200 extra divisions in the West. And Pétain rightly said, that means that we are facing 200 German divisions, and they can put 100 in reserve and send 100 against us. And they was really tired and battered. And that's what the Germans did. Ludendorff made 47 divisions of stormtroopers armed with flamethrowers and grenades to penetrate the weak points. And the only thing that slowed them down, they did split the French and the English up, and the English was almost pushed back into the sea. Paris was under serious red alert of being captured, and the only thing that stopped them was lack of food and supplies. I read today that they didn't even have bandages by this stage, the Germans. That's how bad it was. And one of the things psychologically which messed up the troops was capturing British supply dumps, because of the amount of food there, they hadn't saw it for 2 or 3 years. So they gorged themselves on food and had a good rest and all that. And by this time, the kind of zeal of the attack kind of petered away. And then the Americans landed with their 200,000 men and all fresh supplies and everything. And at the same time, the German allies, Bulgaria and the Ottomans, was all collapsing. So the Germans, even though they was near the Channel ports and they had great victories, they had no supplies. All their allies was dropping out, and at home people had had enough, and you have the far left reactionaries was causing a lot of trouble in Germany and getting people to stop making arms productions and all this kind of agitation. So all these things kind of added up together, and the Kaiser was told that look, you've not got the support of the army anymore, you need to abdicate. So he did. So that's why Hitler talks about not being beaten, because he was not really beaten. they hadn't really been beaten.
No.
They was winning.
Psychological stuff going on.
Yes.
And, you know, Ludendorff is alleged to have said after the war, there's a quote here, I don't know if it's true or not, it comes from something. It's got a volume 2, page something. The Balfour Declaration was the cleverest thing done by the Allies in the way of propaganda, and that he wished Germany had thought of it first.
That's right. They had been offered it first, but I don't really understand that so much because the Germans didn't own Palestine. But
Was that when the Germans were offered that first? Oh, they had offered them something to help out. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
but I'm not
earlier
sure
on in the 1890s or something, the Jews first hoped Germany, as a growing power, would support their rights in quotes,
yeah,
the homeland.
Yeah. Well, Germany was always in the end had too much ethics going for it to ever seem to win anything. So even though they didn't lose, they never really lost. But well, I guess they did, but only because of the United States. You know, it was supposed to be a European war, but why should the United States come in? Only because Britain is being beat, and then they do anything and everything to get the United States to come in.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were saved both times by the United States. And you can't add so many big powers. Of course, Russia was gone, but the United States was more effective probably than Russia would have been if it had stayed in without the U.S. coming in. But there you go. It's never really a fair fight. And again, they turn to the Jews. Now, how many times have white people and white nations turned to the Jews to help them out of a bind? They always do it.
Yep.
So there's a lesson right there, but it's still going on today.
Do you have we got time to talk about the Germans bringing Lenin into Russia to foment revolution?
Well, we've got a few minutes. I want to say before that, I want to tell the listeners that I don't plan on having a Saturday afternoon show for the next 2 weeks, the next two Saturdays in June, because I need to take some time for myself. So I was just going to announce that tonight, today. But I think this has been a really good show, and we've got, Paul, we've got 2 minutes, so you can, or at least almost 2 minutes, so you can fit that in about Lenin as best you can.
Yeah, well, we'll probably just say then, this is from a book by Peter Hoff in 2011 called Our Century, and he says, in the middle of April 1917, the Germans took a somber decision. Ludendorff refers to it with bated breath. Full allowance, he quotes Churchill at the start, because Churchill was a prolific author, and this foreword is World Crisis, Volume 5. In the middle of April 1917, the Germans took a somber decision. Ludendorff refers to it with bated breath. Full allowance must be made for the desperate stakes to which the German war leaders were already committed. They were in the mood which had opened unlimited submarine warfare with the certainty of bringing the United States into the war against them. Upon the Western Front, they had from the beginning used the most terrible means of offence at their disposal. They had employed poison gas on the largest scale and had invented the Flammenwerfer flamethrower. Nevertheless, it was with a sense of awe that they turned upon Russia.
Okay, Paul, you know, we can go over a little bit. So we'll just go over the 2 hours, and you continue with what you're saying. Don't try to force it in there.
Upon Russia, the most grisly of all weapons. They transported Lenin in a sealed truck like a plague bacillus from Switzerland into Russia. So Hoff writes, Germany's empowerment of Lenin and the Bolsheviks in 1917 was the most serious consequence by far of the Great War. So how exactly did he do it? Alexander Halpand, alias Parvus, had been active on the far-left fringes of the International Socialist Movement for many years. He had gained some notoriety because of his involvement with the St. Petersburg Soviet in 1905. Beginning in 1910, Parvus had amassed a fortune, acted as an advisor in various capacities to the Young Turks in Constantinople. the details of which remain murky. He was now about to become the main conduit through which the infusion of millions of German gold marks would elevate Lenin's tiny band of Marxist incendiaries to a position of absolute dictatorship over the land of the Tsars. So Parvus is a communist along with Lenin. On January the 7th, 1915, Parvus was received by Freiherr von Rangeheim, the German ambassador to Constantinople, modern-day Istanbul. Parvus pointed out the important fact that Lenin, alone among the revolutionaries, had opposed the war with Germany from the beginning, and that therefore the interests of the German government are identical with those of the Russian revolutionaries. The next day, January the 8th, Rangeheim duly reported the conversation to State Secretary von Jago and suggested that Parvus be allowed to present his plan personally to the Foreign Ministry in Berlin. After stops in Bucharest, Sofia and Vienna, Parvus arrived at the Wilhelmstrasse in late February 1915, where his audience included Dr. Kurt Reitzler, political warfare assistant to the Chancellor. Parvus presented to the German diplomats an elaborate three-point proposal. First, the infiltration of Bolshevik propaganda into Russia. Second, an international press campaign against Tsarism. Third, organizing massive strikes under the slogan Freedom and Peace. He emphasized financial support for massive strikes at the Putilov, Obukhov and Baltic factories in St. Petersburg as being the highest importance. He stated that strikes here and there, the rising produced by distress and the increase in political agitation will all embarrass the Tsarist government. If it takes reprisals, this will result in growing bitterness. If it shows indulgence, this will be interpreted as a sign of weakness and fan the flames of the revolutionary movement even more. The final memorandum which Parvus gave to his German interlocutors on March 9, 1915, is described by his biographer as a unique document, a plan on a vast scale for the subversion of the Tsarist Empire. Parvus had drafted a blueprint for the revolution. It was practical, detailed, with all its parts, creating an impressive whole.
Now, who Meanwhile, is Parvus?
He's involved with Lenin in the fomenting revolution in Russia.
Where does he come from?
I hadn't come across him before, but he comes up in this. He's like a middleman in this deal to between Germany and Russia to get Lenin into Russia.
And where are you getting this from?
It's from a book by. Where is it? Peter Hoff, Our Century, in 2011.
So it's from a book by somebody. Okay.
So meanwhile, Parvus went to Copenhagen, where he set up a research organization, ostensibly to study the social effects of war, but actually to recruit agents. He also set up an export-import business, which eventually became a profitable enterprise and served to enable the transfer of German funds to the Bolsheviks. He was determined to deliver on his promise to the Germans to foment strikes in St. Petersburg and worked towards this end in conjunction with Count Brockdorf, Rantzau and Baron Gisbert von Rumberg, the German ministers to Copenhagen.
Reading this like this, Paul, it's a little bit hard to get the import, and how much more of it are you going to read? I mean, can you just describe
what happened? In a nutshell, the Germans gave millions of gold marks, and Lenin had been exiled in Switzerland, and the German plan was to get Lenin into Russia to start revolution, mm-hmm. with the point being to topple the Tsar, which did happen, and then they could transfer all their divisions to the Western Front.
Right. You think that the Germans alone were responsible for all of this? I mean, did this happen only because the Germans went along with this plan? Or?
America was involved as well, as you alluded to earlier. They kind of switched their, as far as I can tell, they switched their support from supporting the Tsar to supporting who they saw as the the future winners, the Bolsheviks. And Trotsky was in America, wasn't he? And but there's more complications there.
Yeah, Trotsky was only there for a short period of time. I thought he came from there, but he came from Russia. He got into the USA. He stayed for like 2 weeks or something. And then he went back to Russia. Mm. Or maybe a month. I mean, he wasn't there very long. He's not an American.
Oh, no, no.
No, I used to think he was. And he take, you know, he had a different name. He took the name Trotsky.
Well, here's some interesting stats. Most of the money was used to produce some 42 specially targeted magazines. This is during World War One. These were not the crudely printed pre-1914 handbills and pamphlets, but professional publications printed on high-quality paper. For the soldiers, there was Soldatskaya Pravda. For the sailors, it was Golas Pravda. And frontline troops had Kupnaya Pravda. Each of these distributed an astounding 100,000 copies a day to the troops. The main Bolshevik organ was Pravda, of which 1.5 million copies per week were distributed free of charge to factory workers who had sparked the March Revolution. So while the German troops was in supposedly a patriotic war for the Tsar, you had all these pamphlets and nicely designed leaflets going to every unit and every factory. And remember, no radio, no TV. I don't know.
Now, wait a minute. You said while the German soldiers were in a patriotic war for the Tsar.
No, well, the Russian soldiers, sorry.
Oh, okay.
Was fighting for the Tsar. This is what the Germans, this is where their money went to make all these leaflets and papers and magazines.
So all their money went there. I don't think all their money went there.
Well, no, but the money they gave.
Uh-huh.
To the Russian.
It's known that the Germans helped do that in order to get start a revolution in Russia to get Russia out of the war. Of course, Russia had declared war on Germany. They didn't have to do that either, but they did, right? Protecting their Balkan, as they said, our Balkan little brothers or something like that.
I would say it is quite a good move on the point of the Germans. I mean, money well spent to get a whole enemy, Russia.
Yeah, except that when they got rid of Russia, what year was that? Was that 1918 already?
16, no, I think 16.
Oh, 1916. So they got Russia out, and then the U.S. came in.
Yeah, U.S. came in a
in
year
17.
Later. Yes,
yeah.
There was a period of time where there was more German troops available than Allied troops, which is probably the only time you can say that. And
right.
That was when Ludendorff went for the jugular, but they went so far so quick and they just didn't have the supplies.
That's right. They had a good plan and it was like a blitzkrieg, but the supplies couldn't keep up and they ended up with no food.
Yeah,
and
there's only so much you can ask a man with no food and no bandages and no medicine to do.
So I don't know. What's your final judgment? Is this bad luck by the Germans or is it something else? Is it poor planning and poor...
losing World War One?
Strategy? Yeah, why it turned out that way it did.
Well, I think it was the Jews in America who persuaded the Americans to join the war, because if not for that, there would have had to been a more amicable peace.
That's right. So
and then you probably wouldn't have had World War II.
Yeah, so there would have been an armistice, there would have been some kind of a peace thing. Wouldn't have been like Versailles at all.
No, it would have been an honorable armistice where both sides keep a degree of honor, and then you move on from there, like the European wars of old.
But when you think about that, probably the French would have done it because they're not. But I don't know. It seems like the British would try everything they could possibly think of before they'd go along with that. And they did with getting promising things to the Jews to get America in.
Well,
right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what they're doing, yeah.
So that's what this Landman document is. It's showing that at the end, the British could not accept that kind of a peace or that kind of a draw or whatever after all the And then they're always thinking about their own public opinion. And they worry about they're going to be put out of office and so on because of it. And that all these men had been killed and wounded and maimed and so on. And now they were going to end up with nothing more than they had before. And they couldn't tolerate that either, could they?
No.
I think they couldn't. And the French had lost even more. Maybe the French were more stubborn about it, too, than I realize.
Yeah, I think the French honor was really badly hurt.
It was.
You know, the Verdun stuff, where they lost the ancient fort and all that kind of thing. They was not used to losing so badly, and they had all the memories of the good days and all their empire and stuff. And they became a bit of a minor player, really, because obviously if it was Germany beats France 1-1, it would have been over in a few months.
Yes.
You know, and that's, I suppose that's a bit of a pill to swallow if you're a patriotic Frenchman.
Well, so we have all of this stuff going on, you know, and you've got the Russian Revolution started. It got the problems in Palestine started. And it got the future problems in Europe and World War II and all because of the Versailles Treaty. Horrendous. Horrendous is World War One.
Total disaster.
Yeah. Well, that's one place to stop. That's our opinion. Do you have any final words you'd like to say on this?
Not really. Maybe we could talk in future about do a show about what happened afterwards, because we did mention we maybe talk about the Kiel Mutiny, but we never had time to talk about it. But what I've heard is that several German cities got taken over by far-left revolutionaries.
Yes, all of that, yeah. That's
and I'm thinking is maybe that where the Freikorps come from, out of that.
That all took place, that's right. That's a whole other story. But I think we made a real good presentation here of some of the causes for World War One, or it's better to say the tensions that built up and so on that a lot of people never think about. People simplify it quite a bit, and all of these other aspects of it, which just pretty much not a single one of them is it. It's they all go together, and when these things build up together, you know, it eventually explodes, doesn't it? And nobody's worrying about that as much. They're all worrying about losing face or losing the current little feud they're in or the current little battle they're in, right? Human nature and the failings that we still have among human beings are really the cause of all this problems that we have at bottom. But we can't change human nature. I don't know if it's improving. There's another question. Are human beings any better than they were as cavemen? Probably worse because we've got a lot more dangerous stuff to do to one another, right?
I think we're more informed. I mean, in the World War One time, if you'd been British or French and you'd said, I'm not going, and that kind of thing, I'm not fighting for big oil, they'll say, what are you talking about, big oil? What are you talking about, big corporations?
Yeah.
Whereas today, there would be an awful lot of people saying, I'm not going to fight in some World War Three to fight for the Rothschilds oil concerns or that kind of thing, and people are behind that. So
look at the Iraq War, how they managed to manipulate that and get all these people. But they didn't want a draft. They don't want a draft anymore because they know the draft will bring up what you just said.
But if they have
volunteers, they're the gung-ho ones who fall for it. But now they're going to mercenary troops and they're going to illegal immigrants and all kinds of stuff like that. What to fight these wars? It's very scary. It's just terrible. And sometimes I think our focus should be more on a lot of these practical matters than just on race, and Jews. Because there's a lot of I don't know. I don't think we have the talent that we need, truthfully, to accomplish very much.
Yeah, I think I was involved in a demonstration with National Action the other week, which was in the Daily Mirror, which was against capitalism and international capitalism and stuff. So I think we should do more of that kind of thing, you know. to explain to people what, why are we all in debt and why are all these wars going on?
It's, yeah, well, you know, this has been done. It's been done on the internet, and I know millions of people see it. And there are a lot of people who know. They know about the Federal Reserve. They know about the, you know, the wars. They know about these things. But then they just don't want to be. They don't want to be unhappy, and they don't see how they can do anything about it. So they just ignore it.
Mm.
And that's, this is where I think real strong, powerful leadership comes in. You need somebody to really, you know, attract people and work up something. And that's what we're missing. But I don't want to stop on this, end on this kind of a note, like, you know, complaining about things that I can't do anything about it, and it's really nobody's fault. So,
yeah.
So anyway, I thank you, Paul, for coming on. I think we did a good job. This has been a very interesting show. I bet there'll be a lot of people listening to it. So, Paul, you want to give anything about your website or your own program on Renegade?
Yes, I still write the Birmingham Nationalist, which people are welcome to visit, and I do Voice of Albion on Renegade Broadcasting, which is 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 9 p.m. British Time, every Wednesday, and I've already had some quite good guests. Which people could go over to Renegade and have a listen to those shows. I like to keep it practical in the sense that I have people on who are organisers or leaders of parties, and I try not to just talk about things, but hopefully you know, give people some ideas of what they can do, and tell them via the guests what other people are doing in other countries. The Australian First Party, I did an interview with Jim Salem. I'll especially tell people to check that out, because they're doing very well in Australia, and I think his way, his three-tier approach, is the way forward for any white country, really. So that would be one I would definitely tell people to listen to.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Paul Hickman, and this is Carolyn Yeager saying goodbye for Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn on this June 14th. And as I said, probably won't have a Saturday afternoon for the next 2 weeks unless something comes up that I just can't stop from talking about. But I will still be having the Heretics Hour and, of course, the Table Talk with Ron Ray Goodwin. So that's it for today. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Goodbye.